For the week of January 25th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 266, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Park City, Utah, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the heart of the snowpocalypse in New York City, I'm Michael Giltz.
That's right. Now, I am up here in Park City, Utah for the Sundance Film Festival, which always takes place in this ski resort, Park City, Utah, an old silver mining town. But everybody here from New York, everybody that's here, all the journalists, all the distribution executives, everybody you can think of, they are concerned about what is going on in New York because, of course, they all have to venture back to New York over the next 2 to 3 days, and it's looking more and more likely that they won't be able to go.
Well, they're not concerned so much as annoyed. It's not dangerous. It's just, you know, a problem. Yeah, and if they shouldn't be leaving the festival 2 days into it, so what, right? I mean, they shouldn't be leaving on Tuesday. They should be staying to the end.
Well, no, I mean, Tuesday is a good day to leave, actually, because you're more than halfway through the festival, and you've seen most of what you've probably come to see.
Yeah. They always leave early at con, too. I don't buy it.
You have lives to get back to.
So if they're trapped at the airport, and they're wondering, my God, am I ever going to get home, and they need to take their mind off their travails, they'll be listening to this show. And if they are, what will they be hearing about?
Well, apparently they're going to be hearing about the big blizzard, which is affecting New York City. Although, has it started snowing there yet?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, so there's a big blizzard in New York City. They're also going to be hearing about, well, we've already started talking about it, the Sundance Film Festival, the bastion, I don't know, what would you call it? It's a film festival for independent films and filmmakers, and it brings 50,000 people to Park City, Utah every year. And we will be talking about some of the trends and some of the hot titles and everything about this year's Sundance Film Festival. We'll also be touching on the Producers Guild Awards. And what else do we have on store, Michael? I think that's pretty much it. There's no Sony news this week, but we also have Big Deal, Big Whoop, where we cover all the big entertainment headlines for the past week. But first, as always, we're going to turn it over to you, Michael, entertainment journalist extraordinaire. Michael Giltz, you're going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
I wonder if people could tell that you're winging it this
week.
I'm
totally winging it. Yes, I'm totally winging it. I'm working on like 2 hours sleep. And not because I was out partying. I'll tell you that much.
And you're recording the show on like a tape deck, you know, like it's so archaic the way you're doing this. But anyway.
That is true. I brought all this recording equipment to Park City, Utah. And guess what? All of it worked except for one piece, and now I had to kind of jury-rig something so that we could record this week's show because we didn't want you to go without a show this week.
So the show is being recorded directly onto a 78 shellac, and then we'll take that, we'll play it on an old Victrola, and then we'll record through the horn the actual audio, and then we'll digitize that and send it out to the world. Is that about right?
I have no idea what you just said, but I'm sure I can figure it out.
Well, we're talking about the box office now. We're talking about the box office around the world. We get our info from RentTrack. There's a note in the show notes. There's also info from Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profits. And everybody agrees the number one movie in North America and around the world is American Sniper, another $81 million. It's at $250 million worldwide. Records are falling every week. It looks like it's going to be the highest grossing war film in North American history.
And that beats Saving Private Ryan? Really?
That's right. I mean, I assume we're not considering Gone with the Wind a war movie.
Well, war takes place in it.
It does. It does. And of course, we're not adjusting for inflation. So, but still, that is a big accomplishment for American Sniper, which is, you know, part of the award season. I'm very excited. Number two around the world is The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. This grossed another $57 million. It's at $866 million worldwide. That big jump in gross was due to opening in China, and they look like they will be marching their way towards $1 billion worldwide, most of that overseas. And as Variety pointed out, there's an element to this movie that we don't often cover when we look at worldwide box office, and that is the currency. The dollar, ruble, the yen, the euro. Some movies, you know, can make a lot of money in countries where the dollar is too strong, and that means you bring back just very little less money. You can be just as popular as the last one, but because that currency is weak, you're going to only take home so much money. So as Variety says, it's this movie's adaptation, this particular edition, has been undermined by global currency issues. In many territories, such as Russia, it has drawn larger crowds than previous installments, but the strength of the dollar, the decline of the euro, and the ruble's free fall are resulting in lower receipts. China happily does not have that issue. It has a strong currency right now, and that's a relief to MGM and Warner Brothers because the movie is doing so well there. So when you look at a movie's worldwide box office, you have to take into account sometimes how strongly are different territories doing, how much money can you actually bring home. You may sell more tickets than ever, but if their currency is devalued too much, that's not going to mean many bucks once you get it back to the U.S.
Yet at the same time, and one of the things I'm learning up here at Sundance this year is that for international distributors, they really look to play off of the release in other territories, be it America or elsewhere. If it's being released, then you pretty much you don't want to be 2-3 years behind waiting for currency fluctuations to right themselves or
Oh, no, nobody's suggesting that you delay release because of you're going to wait for a currency uptick. But when you're evaluating how well a movie does, it's helpful to say, hey, The Hobbit is trending just a tad behind the last two Hobbit movies. But in fact, ticket sale wise, it's doing great. In Russia, actually, we were talking about the ruble free fall. They're actually taking a page from the playbook of China, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're going to either install a quota system or they're going to do something to kind of limit the power of Hollywood or the domination of Hollywood in the Russian territory.
They're really trying to protect their own film industry, which is growing. They're going to micromanage movie releases just like China. They're going to protect key Russian films against Hollywood releases, meaning the culture ministry will be in charge. And just like in China, they'll block out certain dates and make sure only Russian films open, or they'll just push Hollywood movies off to a less favorable date and things like that, just to make sure their films have the best chance to succeed at the market and perhaps to also punish movies or studios or companies that they're not happy with. So that's somewhat like what you see in China, and that's going to be coming to Russia. Meanwhile, number three around the world is Taken 3, Liam Neeson's film, another $33 million. That's a $230 million worldwide. Paddington is doing well. The family film grossed another $16 million. That will pass the $200 million mark, I should say, next week. Big Hero 6 is looking to be a success. That grossed $15 million. That's at $456 million. It was an expensive movie to make, as many animated films are, but it is definitely going to hit big profitability.
Yeah, you said it was looking to be a success. I would say it's already a success.
Well, it cost $160 million to make. So by our rough rule of thumb, you got to at least triple that worldwide.
True.
In order to, especially with a big movie like that, it's going to have a big release schedule. It's going to have a big marketing plan and stuff like that. If you're looking at a movie like Birdman, which is way down at number 21 on the Rentrax worldwide release. That grossed $5.8 million. It's at $42 million worldwide. We'll get to the awards later. But that costs $18 million to make. So using our, even now, I would say it's probably in profitability because while it's a high-profile movie, it didn't have the big campaign that something like Big Hero 6 would have. Isn't that true?
Well, yeah, and I would also say, well, it certainly has a large, Academy campaign and awards campaign, mm-hmm. but you saw Birdman this week.
I did, and I hated it. Oh, my God, I really did not like it at all. So that's some shocking news coming up. At number six around the world is the Jennifer Lopez thriller, The Boy Next Door. Teachers should not date their students. It grossed $15 million in its opening weekend and did very well. It was a modestly budgeted movie. She opened it up decently. It's going to make money. At number seven is Kevin Hart's The Wedding Ringer. That's at $42 million worldwide. Just below that is another big awards contender. That's The Imitation Game, which is the story of Alan Turing during World War II. That grossed $11 million. That's well past the $100 million mark. At number nine is Night at the Museum 3. That passed the $300 million mark. At 10 is Penguins of Madagascar from the beleaguered DreamWorks Animation people. That's them. Oh, no, it's not, is it?
Yeah, no, it is. DreamWorks Animation. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
And by beleaguered, I mean, well, I guess we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, I guess that, I get confused sometimes because they don't distribute their own movies anymore. Maybe they never did. It's being distributed by Fox, and
that's
at $320 million. And number 11 is probably the big news of the week. There were two big flops of movies that opened in North America. And the first one is starring Johnny Depp. It's called Mordecai. It's sort of a nutty caper film, sort of like Inspector Clouseau, except nobody liked it.
That's true. I love what the headline Vulture had for this particular film. It said, "It's great Johnny Depp seems to be having so much fun in Mordecai because no one else will."
Ouch.
Yeah.
Yes. As somebody else said, now you know why there's a Pirates of the Caribbean movie in the works.
That's right. You got to get your stock back up.
Nonetheless, Johnny Depp also appears in a smaller role in Into the Woods, and I'm sure his star power there helped this movie get to where it's at, which is a big success story. It's at $9 million worldwide this weekend, and it's at $155 million and counting. It's crossed $120 million in North America alone. That is a huge number for a musical. And well down at number 15 is a new entry in South Korea. It's Gangnam Blues. It's a South Korean drama starring pretty boy Lee Hin Mo. He was so handsome, the director didn't want to cast him, but he changed his mind. He cast him, and now the movie has launched successfully.
Now, do you think Gangnam Blues has Gangnam Style?
It might. I don't. That's a territory. That's a region, a city, an area in Korea. And so that's a reference to that. It's not a reference to the song. The song is a reference to the area as well. So they have that in common, but it's not a reference to that novelty hit.
Yes, God. But it did make for a good joke.
It did make it for a good joke.
Okay.
So as we mentioned earlier, Birdman is still doing well. It costs $18 million to make. It's going to triple its budget. It's probably profitable already, but it really made big news over the weekend, didn't it?
Yeah, I guess everybody figured that the PGA, the Producers Guild of America, that they would give their award to Boyhood because, you know, how do you produce a movie over 12 years? And Boyhood has been sweeping every other, awards that it's been in, at least on a general category. So they just figured the PGA would award Boyhood on Boyhood's run to a Best Picture Oscar win.
And if there was a movie with momentum, it was probably American Sniper, which we don't know when it opened versus when they closed their voting. But that certainly is the movie that has captured everyone's attention and looked like, oh, hey, maybe there's a dark horse to upset Boyhood's march to the Oscars.
Well, but then here you've got Birdman coming in to kind of steal the thunder.
That's right. Birdman won the PGA award and it won Best Cast, which is the Screen Actor Guild's equivalent to Best Picture. So it won essentially Best Picture from the PGA and the Screen Actors Guild. The actors and the producers love Birdman.
Well, for Birdman, I mean, you look at Michael Keaton and the acting branch of some of these groups, they're huge. It's huge. So it's huge to overcome a performance like Michael Keaton's in Birdman. I know you hated it, but
the acting contingent at the Oscars is the single largest voting block. Of course, there is no acting contingent at the Screen Actors Guild. They're all actors.
Yes,
and
that's
true.
And it
is a movie about acting, and there are no actors in the Producers Guild. They're all producers. There may be some actors who are also producers, but essentially it's producers. So yes, the producers appreciated the making of this film. The actors love that it's about acting. I thought the movie was ridiculous. I can't imagine anyone involved in making a movie or involved in the theater or ever having dealt with the media could not watch this movie and just giggle at how ridiculous it is. But that's just me.
I think you stand in the minority there.
Not from the friends I know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I didn't know anybody who really liked this movie. I had one friend who liked it. But most others were very down on it. I wasn't excited to see it, but I felt I owed it to the movie. It has a long fake tracking shot throughout the film, which I found just exhausting and tiresome.
Well, it's a single shot movie. They did the whole movie.
They did not do it in a single shot. It's just made to look like a single shot, and it's exhausting and tiresome and calls attention to itself and serves no purpose whatsoever other than to distract and annoy you. And there's a scene towards the end where an actor confronts a theater critic, which is so absurdly ridiculous. I wish they meant it satirically, but they didn't.
Oh, you mean where, okay, yeah, it's like a theater critic for like the New York Times or something like that.
Yes, writing on a notepad, because that's what theater critics do. They craft their reviews in pen and paper, you know?
Like at a bar, no less. At a dimly lit
like
bar.
It's the 1920s or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they're happy. They had a great weekend, and now there's certainly another movie that perhaps will make the Oscars more exciting than it seemed.
Well, I certainly hope the Oscars are more exciting than they seem, or will appear to be from,
it looked like Linklater's Boyhood was winning everything in sight, so it just seemed like it was going to march all the way to victory. Now there's a story to be told. Birdman, Sniper, and Boyhood, with the dark horse also of Grand Budapest Hotel. I wouldn't rule that out. So there's a fair number of movies that are actually in the mix, and that makes for suspense, and that makes for potentially a better show.
Well, and the PGA also awards television, right?
Yes, not that I care.
Okay, well, you know, one thing we should point out, and maybe you did this already, I mean, I really am tired. I'm exhausted. This festival going is tough stuff sometimes. But the PGA and the – it's been 8 years since the PGA and Oscars differed on who they picked for Best Picture. The PGA selected Little Miss Sunshine back 8 years ago, and it went the Best Picture went to The Departed.
That's right. Those sort of tea leaf reading are kind of meaningless. It's not like anybody says, oh, the PGA voted for it. I guess I have to as well. It just happens to be that they're in sync for a while and then they fall out. The Golden Globes were in sync for a while and then they fall out. The PGAs were in sync for a while and now maybe they fall, you know. So this none of that, it all shows patterns when you look back. But if you're trying to predict what's going to happen this year, it's pretty meaningless. You know, if one movie wins every single award in sight on its way to winning the Oscars, chances are it's a favorite. But, you know, if there's some weird fill-up like that, like the PGA or something, that doesn't really mean anything. It's just patterns you look for in the past and hope to predict in the future, but it never actually works.
Well, now, one
pattern... look at the PGA Awards, I beg your pardon. They also awarded Best Animated Film to The Lego Movie and Best Documentary to Roger Ebert's film Life Itself. Not a film about Roger Ebert, I should say. Neither of those are up for their particular categories at the Oscars. So if you say, oh my God, the PGA chose Birdman, clearly that's the favorite. They didn't even choose the movies that were nominated for the other categories for their other big movie stuff. So hey, clearly they don't always agree with the Oscars.
Well, do you think the trend of executives getting big pay raises will continue? Because certainly last week we spoke about Bob Iger. He got a big jump, I think 40-some-odd million dollars or $36 million. I can't remember how much, but it was so much money I can't even remember. And now we have Viacom CEO Philip DeMann. He's getting a 20% raise to $44 million, while Chief Operating Officer Thomas Dooley last year, he made $35 million. Or actually, I guess you mentioned here, since he's too embarrassed to actually get the $35 million, it's $34.95 million.
Right. He's not worth that extra $50,000 to round it up.
Right.
And of course, $50,000 at Viacom is known as chump change, or probably more than the actual salary of most employees of Viacom and its subsidiaries.
Yeah, it's true.
But, you know, the next year they'll get a pay cut. The year after they'll get a pay raise. It just fluctuates with the stock market. It fluctuates with, you know, their particular performance that year. But when you're looking at getting $44 million versus $36 million or whatever it might be, it's really kind of meaningless at that point, isn't it? That's lottery money every single year. Sumner Redstone, for example, got a 64% pay cut. He only got $13.2 million this year. Of course, he has a lot of stock in Viacom, but his actual salary was a pay cut, a massive pay cut. So, you know, we've set up a PayPal account, and if you want to make a donation to Sumner, you can, and we'll pass that along to him to help him out during these tough times. There's also tough times at DreamWorks Animation, aren't there?
Oh, I would say that's actually very, very true. They're firing. We mentioned this last week, that they're laying off 500 people. Some top executives are leaving, and they're expanding from three animated films, producing three animated films and releasing three animated films per year, which is what they had been doing, to they're going down a film to two. And they called it, quote unquote, too ambitious to try and release three films a year.
Right. Well, actually, last week we reported that the rumors or the word in the street was that they might kill 150 to 400 jobs. They've ended up cutting 500 jobs. That's truly depressing. I mean, that's a big change. And of course, Wall Street reacted with the briefly, the stock rose more than 3% in after hours trading. Then it fell again. And you look at their next six movies. They have Kung Fu Panda 3. Then they have a movie based on the Troll dolls called Trolls and Boss Baby. Then they have The Croods 2, a sequel to that big hit. And then they have, beyond that, How to Train Your Dragon 3. So they have three big sequels out of their next six movies and three other movies, Trolls, Boss Baby, and Larrikins, that they hope to launch new franchises. So they have really good movies that are in the works. They never actually, I don't think, I'm double-checking here. I'm going to say there was 1 year where they released... 2 years where they released three movies. That was 2010, where they released How to Train Your Dragon, Shrek Forever After, and Megamind. I would call that a success. That was $1.6 billion they grossed off movies that cost $350 million to make. And then this year was the other year, 2014, I should say, was the other year where they actually released three movies at a time. And that was Mr. Peabody and Sherman, How to Train Your Dragon 2, and Penguins of Madagascar. Again, you're looking at $1.3 billion off of three movies that cost $430 million to make.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess, I don't know. I don't know whether this is just they can get it done cheaper overseas in Asia, all this animation, or whether it's just mismanagement. But, you know, yeah, they had a run of bad films, but they also had some big hits. I agree with you. I can't figure it out. And I'm
You don't have a big library, and you don't have a big company backing you up. You can't weather those cyclical storms that are always going to occur, you know? Like, you need that library, you need that bit, you know, if Disney has a weak year at movies, they've got TV on ABC, or they've got sports on ESPN, or they've got theme parks. All those things sort of feed into each other. Success begets success. But also, if you have failure in one area, you may have success in another. And when you're just a company doing just animation, and you're only releasing two or three movies a year, you know, those the hits and misses get magnified a big deal.
Wait a second. Now, were you trying to move us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense?
I certainly was, because the snow is rising, and I'm worried that once it gets past my knees, I won't be able to move anymore, and I may freeze into place. So I'd love to get the show done as soon as possible.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, let me tell you about Mrs. Doubtfire, because Robin Williams lives! Well, at least his film properties live on. One of the actor's most successful, though certainly not one of his most acclaimed roles, was as the estranged dad who disguises himself as the Scottish nanny Mrs. Doubtfire to get closer to his kids. The blockbuster comedy is being turned into a musical, and the team behind this project, this Mrs. Doubtfire project, is top-notch. Alan Menken, one half of the greatest musical theater team since Rodgers and Hammerstein. Now, who was the other half of that? Do you remember who the other half of that was? I'm sure you do.
Ashman, sure.
Yeah, Howard Ashman. Yeah. He is writing the music. David Zippel is doing the lyrics, and Harvey Fierstein, ironically, is doing the book. He was actually, he had a small part in the movie as well, playing the brother of Robin Williams' character. Now, don't line up for tickets quite yet, and this is a quote from Menken: "It's going very well, it's in its early stages, and that's probably all I can say. We're really enjoying working on it," which is like saying absolutely nothing. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
It's definitely a big whoop. I mean, who cares? You know, it's a project, they're working on it. It's not even scheduled for out of town tryouts yet, and yet it makes big news. People talk about it. Some theater websites are saying, "Who we'd love to see in drag in the main role," and they list six actors that they love. So, you know, it's a silly property. It's not a very good movie, but it made a lot of money, and who knows, maybe they can turn it into a much better show.
Is that like BuzzFeed? You know, like six actors we think should play.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, Bjork released her new album digitally months ahead of plans. Why? Because like so many other artists, the closer their music gets to its official release, the more people have access to it. One of them apparently leaked a bootleg copy. Her first album in 4 years is about the breakup of Bjork's last relationship and is arguably the most personal of her career. After consulting widely with industry folks, Bjork took the logical step of simply releasing the album digitally right away and letting the CD version catch up when it can. In related news, the leak of Madonna's new album, which was just demos, was traced to an Israeli pop star wannabe who was arrested by police in a joint operation led by Israeli police and the FBI. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. I don't know that more albums are being leaked early lately. I mean, we're hearing about them. I mean, Bjork and Madonna. And there was another one just a little bit ago. And those are big names, of course. But there's a lot of other artists who have big albums out, and those haven't been leaked, obviously. Maybe we're just hearing about it more. People are more aware of it. It is a problem when someone like Beyonce can keep her album completely secret and then release it and drop it all at once. That shows how hard it is in this day and age where there's so many people involved and they all have to keep their mouth shut and they all have to keep their digital copy secure. It ain't easy to do anymore. I don't know if albums are getting stolen more and leaked or whether we're just hearing about it more lately. I don't think that these notable names are an indication that's becoming a bigger problem, but it's clearly one that's never going to go away. And I think they're making the smart move of just saying, hey, if it's out, if we've got the album ready, we just got to get it out.
I agree. I think that once it's out, you know, you can't pull it off BitTorrent sites.
It's not going to disappear.
Yeah. The big kerfuffle for retailers was that, you know, of course, those who had planned on releasing CDs, like Amazon, they felt left out because it was released through iTunes
It was only released through iTunes?
At least initially, yeah. They basically gave it to iTunes, and Amazon was going to have this exclusive. If you buy the album, you get the digital stuff free. And, you know, I think that so they were very upset. So all these retailers, especially the e-retailers who do sell physical media, felt, you know, that they were kind of left out in the cold.
Well, I'm looking to see if I don't see it. They had an audio CD. It's going to be officially released on March 3rd. It only seems to be available on Amazon on advance order for LP and CD and coming out March 3rd. So I don't see them having a digital version. So maybe you're right about that as well. No, wait, I'm looking at CD and vinyl. Wait, let me get to music. It's interesting if they wouldn't make it available at all. But no, I clicked on Show Me All Formats and it's not there. So.
Okay, browsing with Michael.
Well, it just seems. Hold on. It's vulnerability. No, it's here. I thought that was bizarre. Now that's stupid because my thing was tagged on Amazon as just CD and vinyl because I don't want to see the digital first when I shop. And so, but then it said click on all releases, and all they showed me were CD and vinyl. They didn't show me the digital. I think that's pretty dumb.
So you can officially you can buy Bjork's new album at Amazon on their digital music store.
Yes, I think it would be bizarre if they had cut out everybody else and just gave it to iTunes. Why punish everybody else just because it was hacked?
Yeah, good point. Now, what do you make of the Israeli singer being arrested for...
I don't know. He's not a singer. He's a singer wannabe, as far as I know. He's a guy who, you know, tried to go on a reality show. So, I mean, he's right. You steal an album, you release it online. Even if you're not profiting from it, you're damaging people's business. I'm a big anti... theft guy.
Yeah. Well, apparently he missed his calling. He should have been a black hat hacker.
There's a flop movie. Wow.
Oh. Yikes. Yeah. And I totally did not mean to reference it. That's true. Now, best-selling author James Patterson has a hit factory. We've talked about him before. He's pairing with various co-authors to turn out a bestseller seemingly every other
week,
it seems like, in one of the most successful publishing phenomenons in history. Well, his newest book, it's a bomb, okay? And Patterson couldn't be happier about it, which makes no sense initially. But in fact, his newest book is a publicity stunt. The novel Private Vegas, co-written with Maxine Pietro?
I don't know. She's a lucky person, whoever she is.
Well, it comes out January 26th. But before that, so today, actually, anyone with $300,000 to burn, so we should call Philip DeMann and Bob Iger and all those
but
folks.
But not Sumner. Sumner's counting his pennies this week.
That's true. Well, anybody with that much money, they could get a sneak peek because the lucky buyer who spends $300,000 on buying the book gets a trip to an undisclosed location, two nights in a very fancy hotel, dinner with Patterson, gold-plated binoculars, and a copy of the book that literally self-destructs in 24 hours. I'm a slow reader. This would be a big problem for me. The winner gets to read the book and then watch as a bomb squad takes the copy and lets it explode over a volcano. 1,000 more fans with less money to burn could win access to ebook advances whose pages disappear after they are read. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, James Patterson has always been an innovator in advertising and publicity. This is just a publicity stunt. I thought for a second he'd written an original book and you'd be the only person in the world to ever get to read it. I thought that was kind of cool. But in fact, it's just a goofy stunt. The new book's coming out. I don't know if anybody took him up on it. I tried to figure that out, but it got him a lot of press. People all over talked about this stunt and talked about what he was offering and talked about that the new book was coming out. You could only pay $20, $28 if you wanted, you know. So they just did everything they could and it helped the book in every possible way. And you can buy it on Amazon for $10.
Well, you know what James Patterson did for a living, even while he was a successful author and he had movies being made of his books, he still kept his job as an executive. Do you know where?
Well, I know he's an ad person.
Yeah, at an advertising agency.
Oh, yeah, everybody knows that. Yeah, he's a big guy. He's one of the few authors. He when you see ads for James Patterson's novels on TV or in print, a lot of times he is self-funding them. He pays for them because he, as he always says, the publishers are not doing a good enough job promoting books. They don't let you know when the book has come out. They don't let you know that it's available. They don't use it. They just put it out and expect people to review it and other people to stream into bookstores and look for it. And
well,
he says that's not enough.
Well, I just want to know where he got a volcano.
I think probably Hawaii.
Well, Paula Abdul is back on Fox as a judge.
Watch out, Simon Cowell.
Well, no. The dancer, choreographer, singer, and Grammy and Emmy winner is not returning to American Idol. Actually, she's getting back to her roots by joining Fox's new season of So You Think You Can Dance. It follows in Abdul's successful stint on the show's edition in Australia, which intentionally or not, served as an audition for the U.S. show. With the departure of Mary Murphy from the modest but demo-friendly dance competition, Abdul might well give the show a welcome jolt of nutty fun. Big yellow, big whoop.
It's a big whoop, of course. You know, personality gets job, as Karen Woodward would say. But I like So You Think You Can Dance. I've always liked the show. I didn't really get into the last round of the show too much, but they got some new twists to the show. Mary Murphy leaving was a big blow to them, so Paula Abdul coming back on board could be a fun thing for them. So I'll check it out and see how she does.
Are you worried that the new Star Wars movies can't live up to the originals?
No, because I know they won't.
Oh, okay. Well,
I'm not being mean. I'm just saying.
I can't believe I'm about to say this, but it could have been much worse. George Lucas was working on screenplays for them.
No!
Exactly. Turns out the man behind the Force had a number of ideas he was developing. But Lucas was unwilling to devote another decade of his life to yet another Star Wars trilogy. His time, he said, was more valuable than the massive money he'd make. Which begs the question, how much is his time worth? You would have made $1 billion a film. Must be very expensive.
When you already have a ton of money, you don't need any more.
Okay, well, when Disney came calling, it was the perfect time for Lucas to let go of it then. He shared his ideas with the studio, and according to him, they said, thanks, but no thanks. But we'll still take the company. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, though I guess in a big deal in a way, they were smart enough to know to pass. The sad thing was he let this little pearl of information drop while doing press to promote his animated film Strange Magic.
Yes.
Which just opened and closed in North American theaters. He said he wrote Star Wars for boys and decided to make a movie for girls. And that movie was Strange Magic. Why does he not like little girls? That's what I want to know. Make them a better movie.
I'll tell you, my girl saw the trailer for this movie in front of Paddington, and they turned to me right after the trailer finished playing and said, "What was that about?"
Oh, God.
I was well. All of a sudden, they're trailer critics, 9 and 8. They're confused. I don't know.
It's genetic.
Well, you know, here we were talking about Disney, and since we're talking about Disney, speaking of Disney, 5 employees of Disneyland have come down with measles. Presumably after a visitor spread the disease there, the company, and this is the park in Anaheim, California, the company has done everything to calm fear, sparing no expense to deal with those employees and bringing in a wave of medical professionals to offer free vaccinations to the 27,000 workers based there. One thing they won't do, however, is mandate all employees must get vaccinated. And this is a quote from a Disney official. "We're doing everything that we possibly can to proactively communicate to our cast members." And this was said by Disney spokesperson Lisa Haynes, using Disney slang for their mostly hourly wage employees. They call them cast members.
We're becoming sort of a left-wing commune when it comes to salaries.
Yeah. In fact, outside the healthcare industry, no employers mandate vaccination, despite hotel, airline, and countless other companies with workers exposed to a stream of customers who might be infectious. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I guess it's a big whoop as long as people don't start to stay away from the parks. They're doing everything they can. It was a new idea to me that companies basically don't require their employees to get vaccinated, even in a case like this, Disneyland, where your bottom line could take a big hit if people suddenly decide, I don't want to go there because I'm going to catch a disease.
Actually, there was a big article in the Los Angeles Times late last year about the fact that you can opt out of getting vaccinated. When it's required if you go to school, if you go to a public school in Los Angeles, unless you opt out of it on belief reasons, reasons
religious
for
grounds, right?
Yeah,
yes.
Or some other belief. And so everybody was just kind of going in and using that excuse on, not everybody, but there was
were using that as an excuse not to get vaccinated.
Well, what they,
because you're an idiot if you don't get your child vaccinated. You are, let me be clear, an idiot.
So would that be one of those smart idiots or one of the dumb idiots?
Yeah, I'm confused. I'm setting aside Christian Scientists. We're talking about mostly people who are using their religious thing as an excuse, as a way to opt out of it because they decide vaccinations are dangerous, or they don't care, or they think they're going to get their kids sick. Those people are idiots.
Well, you know, the big news in this story was that the percentage had increased to some ridiculous percent, like 20-30%. I can't remember.
It was high, which well beyond the range where it's safe, which means that suddenly they're putting your kids at risk because now it's going to spread. I think that was the Hollywood Reporter that did that story, wasn't it? It was either them or Variety. It was a strong, they had a big in-depth story about that.
You're right. And didn't we discuss it at the time?
I think we did. But it's, you know, I had no idea that outside the healthcare industry, I guess it's true. It raises a lot of civil rights issues that companies can't require their employees to get vaccinated. But what fascinated me was this Business Week story. Here's a trivia quiz question for you, Sperling. What year did a hospital in the U.S. become the first hospital to mandate its employees get vaccinated? What was the year?
1996.
Yeah. 2005. It was Virginia Mason in Seattle. And that's how recently, it's just one decade ago, that even hospitals began to require their employees get vaccinated. That's fascinating to me.
Well, measles and mumps, they are highly communicative. They're highly, I guess that would be the right word, right? It can be transmitted quite easily. And it is a vicious, vicious disease. So hopefully it doesn't spread much further.
Yeah, people aren't scared anymore because they've eliminated polio. But do you know how they eliminated polio? Vaccinations.
Everybody got them. Yeah.
That's right. Keep going.
Well, writer and actor Larry David is a bigger star than Bradley Cooper, Daniel Craig, Meryl Streep, Nathan Lane, and Jake Gyllenhaal.
What?
Yes. How else to explain the news that his new comedy and first play, Fish in the Dark, has set a record for the biggest advance in Broadway history for a play? To be exact, people have forked over $13.5 million for tickets to see his comedy, which beat the previous record set in 2013 for Revival of Betrayal starring Craig, a.k.a. James Bond, and Rachel Weisz. Frankly, very few musicals have ever sold that many tickets in advance. The show begins previews on February 2nd, co-stars Rosie Perez, and is about a death in the family. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, my God. Talk about reaching out to a new audience. Clearly, everybody who likes him on Curb Your Enthusiasm and Seinfeld, where he was a cook, you know, involved behind the scenes. Clearly, everybody in his hometown, which is New York, this is his stomping ground. Clearly, they all bought tickets to this show. I'm flabbergasted. I was wondering if it was going to sell any tickets at all. I mean, you know, we don't know what it's about, really. We don't know what it is. He's never been on stage before. It seemed like a huge, huge risk to me. But my God. People are ready to see a Larry David comedy on Broadway.
Chicago, you have a note here, something about Chicago. I can't believe that's even still running.
Right, exactly. That's what I said. I looked through the show. It has been under $600,000 a week for most of the past year and a half, 2 years. There's like 12 weeks last year, I think, where it grossed more than $600,000, which means 40 of those weeks it didn't. And okay. I don't know what the nut is on this show. It's got to be somehow really low. It's got to be like 400,000 because I don't see how they're still running. They're way down in the grosses, way down in the percentage of tickets sold, way down in the potential gross that they're not making. They're down into the 30-40% range, meaning they're only grossing 30-40% of the potential for that house. So I'm not quite sure why they're not calling it a day yet. They've got a constant stream of guest stars, of course, on that show. That's what keeps it fresh as far as tourists are concerned. And obviously that's an expense every time you have to bring someone in and get them up to speed and get them into the show. Obviously they have that system down to a T because they do it all the time. They have TV stars and movie stars and people coming in and out of Chicago. It's a well-oiled machine. I'm delighted that they're still running. I don't want them to close, but looking at the grosses, I don't understand how it's happening. If anybody knows what the weekly nut is for Chicago, let us know.
Dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can email us. In a case with far-reaching implications, American Idol winner Philip Phillips is suing 19 Entertainment over the contracts he had to sign as a contestant on the talent show. Phillips says those contracts are onerous and that 19 Entertainment has not acted in his best interest and has forced him to take work that benefits them and not him. Phillips is citing a California law called the Talent Agencies Act, which has been a useful legal tool when artists like Arsenio Hall and Keisha have challenged commissions they were obligated to pay to their managers. The Phillips lawsuit may take years, and in fact will take years, assuming it isn't settled out of court, which would put past winners, not to mention future contestants of various shows, in legal limbo. The juicy bits include Phillips detailing a poisonous relationship with 19 management, such as not being told the name of his second album, Behind the Light, until it was announced to the world. So the world knew before he did. Big Yeller, Big Whoop.
Well, it's not 19 Management, it's 19 Entertainment, though they're all intertwined. Because he has a management company and a record label, and for your first album or second album, they're sort of, it's the same beast. And so he's not saying that the contract he had to sign was inherently unfair. He's just saying they didn't meet their obligations under the contract, and he's citing the Talent Agencies Act to do that. There are some other people who challenge contracts and say, oh, that seven-year rule that takes place in California, you can't sign a contract that lasts more than 7 years. That's not into play here, but it's fascinating because he's saying, look, they're not doing what's best for me in my career. For example, he says that they made him do a concert for JetBlue, promoting JetBlue, for which he wasn't paid. He's like, why am I doing this? And I'm like, well, they're sponsoring an Idol tour, but he wasn't part of the tour. It was like for a season or two after he won. So he's being forced to perform free concerts to please a company that is sponsoring a tour that he has nothing to do with. He also had to do a corporate gig for an insurance company, and they tried to put that under the contract of endorsement rather than a performance fee, because then the cost to them and whatever what they had to pay out to him was lower. So he also says he was lied to about the mechanical royalties that a producer would get on his albums. It goes on and on and on. It's juicy, fascinating stuff. And if they can make this Talent Agencies Act apply, it's going to have big, far-reaching implications.
Well, they can make the Talent Agencies Act apply, and that's why managers technically, talent managers, are different from talent agents. An agent can actually go and seek work for an individual or for a creative talent. A talent manager can only manage the overall career, and that is why talent agents cannot actually produce content, because you can't be the buyer and seller. There's a conflict of interest there.
And even in your own roles, if you're not doing it properly, he can sue. He said you're not being a good talent agent,
right?
You know, so which is I think part of the argument here. Not only the inherent conflict involved in the multiple companies umbrellas under 19 Entertainment. I'm sure I'm not voicing that correctly legally. They may not be technically under one umbrella, but they're not doing their job. He's like, they're making me do stuff that doesn't help me or my career. So let me out of my contract. Absolutely. Can you imagine not even knowing the name of your album? Like, they won't even tell you. He's like, what's the name of the album? They just tweet it to the world before they tell you. That's pretty bad relationships.
That is, yeah, that's mismanaged. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we are talking about the Sundance Film Festival.
That's right. You're there, Sperling. What is the attendance like? What is the mood like? Is it just another year business as usual? Does it feel like a really up year? Does it feel like a really down year? What's going on at Park Slope?
Park Slope? I don't know. You tell me. I would say it's snowing.
Not Park Slope. I mean, what's it called?
Park City. Park Slope is in Brooklyn. Yeah.
I know what it's like in Park Slope. It's snowy.
That's true. I'd say it's an up year, especially with some films, some of these films up here that are being shown in dramatic competition and the documentary's selling for big bucks. We'll get to that in a moment. But of course, a couple of years ago, we had Beasts of the Southern Wild premiere here. And it was a big deal come Oscar time the following year, you might recall. And last year, a little film called Boyhood premiered here. And now, of course, it's nominated for Best Picture, much like Beasts of the Southern Wild and Little Miss Sunshine before it. And of course, time and again, you have these big films come out of Sundance, and it's started to bring more and more distributors here from more and more places.
But they're not really big films. I mean, most movies that play Sundance, if they're lucky, get picked up and shown somewhere briefly and get to DVD. Very few of them get a big theatrical release, and very few of those actually make significant coin. We're looking at the final grosses for Boyhood and Beasts of the Southern Wild. They're not huge grossing movies, but based on the budgets that they were, that they're successful.
Yeah, they are successful. Like Whiplash, I don't know what Whiplash is at, but Whiplash opened last year's festival, and now, you know, it's nominated for Best Picture.
So that's a great trend as far as, you know, quality, but it's not if they're coming to Sundance to pick Oscar winners, that's kind of a backwards way of doing it, isn't it?
Well, I'm not saying they're coming to pick Oscar winners. They're coming to pick successful movies. It just so happens some of those successful, it's the Oscars and the attention that the Oscars are bringing, as well as some of the successes out of Sundance that are bringing attention to it. And right. International attention as well, especially as some of these ancillary markets on digital platforms begin to mature, all of a sudden there's once again a need for content.
Well, there always is a need for content. Whiplash, by the way, reportedly cost $3.3 million to make. So far, it's grossed $7.6 million. So it's doing quite well. And J.K. Simmons is certainly the front runner to win Best Supporting Actor come Oscar time. But, I mean, Sundance is supposed to be about encouraging American independent cinema. Clearly, that's work because they get more entries every year than ever before. Tons of people, because it's cheaper to make a movie than ever before, and more of them are making them and wanting to get them to Sundance. If you make a movie, and it's an independent movie of any way, shape, or form, your dream is to go to Sundance and win the Audience Award.
Well, yeah, the Audience Award and the Grand Prize. If you can win the Grand Prize, both are equally good, although some would argue one is better than the other. I would say, you know, both are good.
So I've always found that when Sundance movies start to sell for a high amount, that's a sign of bad news. It's a heated up market because they're not going to make back their money most of the time. We've got lots of examples of Sundance movies that were bought for $8 million, $10 million, $12 million. That's a sucker's game. You know, you don't want to pay that much money. It's not a smart thing to do. You want to find talented people who are going to have good careers. Sure, great. But if you're paying $10 million, $12 million, obviously some of them will make money, but most of them are not going to pay out.
Yeah, and there's, you know, buyers up here storming into some of these screenings and storming out, trying to, you know, create bidding wars. There was a bidding war over the film that opened this year's festival, The Bronze, which last year Whiplash opened the festival. So everybody was hoping, you know, for another big start to this year's festival. And they booked a film and programmed a film, which is kind of like Whiplash in that it's it was a comedy and kind of a raunchy comedy and a
Whiplash
crass comedy.
Is a comedy?
Well, okay, you're right. It isn't. It's more of a... You're right.
It's a drama.
It seemed like a pretty strong start.
Commercial? Is
yes.
that what you mean?
Okay, thank you. That's probably the word I was looking for.
Okay.
It starts with C. Do I get any credit?
Keep going.
Okay. So this is a movie that stars Melissa Rauch, was written by Melissa Rauch and Winston Rauch, and it's about a former gymnast, Olympic gymnast who won bronze because, you know, she fell and broke her, you know, Achilles heel. And it's, split people, most people hating it. And, you know, it disappointed, unfortunately.
But I thought you said it sparked a bidding war.
And yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. That's where I was headed with that. Thank you for reminding me. But that's the thing here. It gets middling to bad reviews. And the public, at least up here, the festival goers are kind of, you know, mostly lukewarm to negative about it. And yet it still sparks a bidding war.
Because maybe it's commercial. The movies that play well at Sundance don't necessarily play well across the country. Who are the buyers? Are Amazon and Netflix there? Are they buying movies literally themselves? Do we know if they're there?
They are here. But as a matter of fact, Netflix is here because one of their films opened this year's festival in the documentary premieres, What Happened, Miss Simone? It's a documentary about Nina Simone. They produced the documentary, and it will be appearing there after a short theatrical run. Of course, the theatrical run is simply to get the reviews and be considered for an Oscar.
Well, I don't know if simply, you know.
They have very much said the reason we're doing this is because that is what puts you in contention for an Oscar. Here's the problem.
Right. If you debut a film on Netflix, you're not going to get as much attention as if you debut it in theaters. That's true.
Well, and
what I questioned was the only. Like, well, that's why you do it.
Well, and you need a review, according to the Academy, in the New York Times or LA Times, which is why you release theatrically in those two cities. The problem that they have now with, you know, something like Miss Simone is that the New York Times, realizing that it was a Netflix film, said, oh, we'll give it to the TV guy. So now they won't even have that. They won't have the New York Times review for Academy consideration.
Do you know that for a fact?
Yes, I do.
Has it already opened? I mean, and why wouldn't a review count? If it was reviewed when it debuted in theaters, why would it matter the byline of the person?
That's what I don't understand. I didn't spend a lot of time looking up the rules, but there was... The publicist was explaining to me how the fact that it was Netflix is what got it into, you know, it basically wound up hindering it because Netflix said that they were going to be debuting it and only releasing it for Oscar consideration.
Well, the New York Times needs to rethink that since, like...
It's not the New York Times.
It's the LA Times?
It's the Academy. The Academy needs to rethink.
No, I'm saying the New York Times needs to rethink saying, well, we're not going to review this as a movie when, like, because it's only getting it from, well, that's half the movies that get shown in New York City. They have a nominal release on IFC. What do they think happens at IFC? Half those movies never get shown anywhere except IFC, and then they go right to the channel. You know, the idea that you're gonna punish a movie because you don't think it's a real release, that makes no sense.
True. But, yeah. You know, I think that will change over time.
Why? Yeah. And the Academy needs to rethink itself as well. If it plays in a theater and it gets reviewed, you're done. Did you see the Scientology film?
You know, that was actually shown last night. And after waiting, I guess it was 2 hours to see Me, Earl, and the Dead Girl. And at the time, I did not know that this film had sold for a whopping $13 million.
Come again. It was at the same time you went to see another movie instead of the Scientology movie because this other film, you just wanted to see it. And then you found out later it sold for $13 million.
Okay. I should explain. It sold for 12. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Fine.
You didn't go see the Scientology movie. You didn't see it.
I did not see the Scientology movie.
You didn't care. All right. You went to see this other movie. And?
Well, I went to see it, did not get in. I was there 2 hours early just because I had, you know, some time to kill and I was early. And even showing up 2 hours early, I was shocked that all these people showed up. This film, Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, sold to Fox Searchlight for $12 million, making it one of the biggest sales to ever occur in Sundance history.
That's not a good idea, Fox Searchlight.
I guess. Well, we'll see. I mean, maybe I haven't seen it, so I can't say, but it's supposed to be very commercial. Also commercial is a film called...
I should hope so.
Yeah. But instead of going... To answer your question, instead of going to see the Scientology movie, I went to see...
You stood in line for 2 hours and didn't see something else.
No, I went to see 10,000 Saints instead. So, which is...
I thought you said you're in line for 2 hours to see this other movie.
I was. At the same time...
So you couldn't go anymore. You couldn't go to the Scientology. It wasn't an option anymore.
It was. I could have gotten in line for that, but I decided to skip it.
You think you would have still gotten in? I thought there were tons of people who were cut out. Everybody was trying to get into that show.
Yeah, and there were tons of people cut out of the Scientology movie. There were tons of people left out of Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl.
Okay.
There were tons of people shut out of The Witch, one of the first films to screen here, which is kind of a period piece, takes place in colonial America, in colonial New England. It's
and
a horror
movie. Announced their next project.
They did?
That's the spear. The people behind The Witch have already announced their next, you know, talk about striking when the iron is hot. That's the fast-paced world of the independent cinema world.
Well, and
you know,
they
sell
they
a
are,
movie, immediately line up a new movie.
Well, and entered a bidding war. And, you know, Boyhood was here last year.
Well, you make a bidding war sound so sexy. If two companies express interest, it's a bidding war.
Well, if two companies express interest and then the film sells for $3 million, that's a bidding war. If two companies express interest and it sells for $150,000, that's not a bidding war.
Very good. Thank you.
So, you know, it might be bidding, but it's more like, yeah, okay, I'm not going to pay that much. See you later. That's not a bidding war. That's just two people expressing interest and one's willing to pay more than the other. But when you have three companies circling and the amount of money they're willing to pay goes higher and higher you kind of start hearing word on the street about a bidding war, that's the definition there. But I was about to say Boyhood screened here last year. This year, Ethan Hawke is back with another movie where he plays kind of a deadbeat dad, 10,000 Saints, which was directed by, and I'm going to screw this up, but it's the folks who did American Splendor, Robert Pulcini and Sherry Springer Berman. And, you know, it's a fairly decent movie.
Okay.
Getting good reviews, but you know, I don't know why he wants to keep playing deadbeat dads, but Dope is a film that I think you'll be hearing a lot about. It was picked up here, I think, for $7 million. It's by, I'm going to really mess this up, Rick Famuyiwa. Rick, you know what? My first attempt to pronounce that name was absolutely horrible, but I'm going to let it stand because the film is fantastic. And it's got style, and it takes place in kind of Inglewood in Los Angeles, and it's about a kid who wants to go to Harvard, and he's kind of a really big geek, but he's considered black on the outside, white on the inside, and he gets mixed up in a whole big dope deal, drug deal that goes south, and he has to sell all the drugs, and how's he going to sell all the drugs? Well, it's very well done.
All right. Well, at least you've seen some good movies. And you haven't seen Me and Earl and the Dying Girl yet, have you?
I haven't seen that. The other one that I would mention, the only other one that I would mention, quite frankly, is Diary of a Teenage Girl. And I would suspect if this can get any traction, it's certainly going through the I don't know if it was picked up yet, but it certainly will be.
I believe it was, or at least I saw reviews of it.
Yeah, this is a movie by first-time filmmaker Mariel Heller, and it's based on a graphic novel, the name of which is now escaping me. And it basically revolves around a 15-year-old girl who has an affair with a 35-year-old guy who is the boyfriend of her mother, played by Kristen Wiig, and Alexander Skarsgård is the boyfriend, and Pell Bowley is the, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly, is this new breakout star who plays the 15-year-old girl. She is phenomenal, but, you know, it's there's a lot of sex in it, and it's sex with a, you know, under, you know,
well, it's statutory rape in most states.
And you know, even though it takes place in the 70s, it's there were some people who went off out who were just offended by it, but most people really, really liked it. And as
well,
did
liking
I.
It, liking the movie doesn't mean you approve of statutory rape.
I agree.
You know? Right. I'm assuming the movie doesn't say everybody should do this.
And the graphic novel was written by Phoebe Gleckner.
Okay,
and she's a kind of a well-known cartoonist.
Okay,
an illustrator. So
okay,
okay. The,
so you know, I said sight unseen. Hey, Fox Searchlight, you should not pay $12 million for a movie at Sundance. But then you look at the review of Variety, which says that Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which they say is wildly successful and should outperform The Fault in Our Stars. They say it's destined not only to connect with young audiences in a big way, but to endure as a touchstone for its generation.
You know what?
So I guess that's a rave review.
Yeah, and the amount of people that showed up for that yesterday, even 2 hours early. I mean, I was like, I missed getting in by like two people. I hate it when that happens. But much like many film festivals, or at least some of the big ones, you have all of these people who have, you know, priority badges, and they show up at the last minute and crowded into this film, probably after they heard the rave reviews.
Exactly. It's
shutting all of us, you know, small potatoes out, small fries. So, you know, look, it's interesting up here this year because the Art House Convergence Conference is right before this. It's when all the art house theater owners in North America get together and talk about the trends and certain topics. Then they all come to Sundance and they spend, you know, the weekend here, and they usually leave Tuesday or Wednesday. But what's really fascinating to me is the number of international journalists and international distributors that have found their way here. In years past, it was mostly North American or Canadian journalists and distributors that showed up, very few international distributors. Now it's like standing in line at Cannes. Standing in line for one of these screenings, you can hear every accent, every language being spoken. It was never like that before. It's slowly grown over the past 2 to 3 years.
And that's interesting because at Cannes, you will see fewer journalists from North America, I would think.
Yes, and that's because of how expensive it is. However, this year, because of the euro, something we talked about earlier in the show, I would not be surprised if you see more.
Oh, going back to Europe.
Correct.
Oh, right.
Because the euro declined or is reaching parity with the dollar, it will be cheaper for North American journalists and North American distributors to make their way over there.
There you go.
But, you know, overall, it's been it started out kind of slow, this year's festival, and has really taken off. I mean, there's like 3 or 4 or 5 good movies. And, you know, those are just the dramatic competition. I haven't even told you about Finders Keepers, which is the film, the documentary film about two guys fighting over an amputated leg found in a barbecue grill. That's the kind of movie you find at the Sundance Film Festival.
When do you come back?
I come back on Friday, so I don't stay for the awards, but I come back, I stay almost to the bitter end.
All right.
Which I know you like. You don't like it when people leave.
That's right.
Yes. Okay, well, that kind of wraps up our show for today, and believe it or not, we're almost under an hour.
Well, we got an obituary to do first.
Oh, you know what? Can we actually make a request? People, stop passing away. It really just messes up our timing.
Well, in this case, it's Joe Franklin, who's a talk show legend here in New York City. He's on local TV for decades, from the 50s to the 90s, really. I'd see him at screenings and at theater events all the time, right up to just a few years ago. He's become more and more frail. He died at 88 years old of prostate cancer. He's literally interviewed hundreds of thousands of people in a rickety, tiny little studio in Midtown Manhattan. He was a real pioneer of late night TV. He was parodied by Billy Crystal on Saturday Night Live. At one point, Bette Midler and Barry Manilow provided his in-house entertainment. I mean, he interviewed everybody. You know, so he was a real legend, a real fixture, not a guy who profited wildly from what he did, but he did it for a long, long time.
Well, hey, you know what? Maybe if we do this long enough, we'll get, you know, Bette Midler and Barry Manilow as our in-house entertainment.
Well, I think he got them before they were big.
Oh, so
I think that's the trick. Though I will say that Barry Manilow's new album is very good. His best, one of his best of his career.
Well, you know what? I'm going to call 19 Management or 19 Entertainment and see if we can get Philip Phillips. We don't have to pay him, apparently. Okay, so then that officially wraps up the show for this week. We should tell you that you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher, and I ran into the folks from Apple. They said if we got a ton of reviews, if everybody who listens to this show went and reviewed the show in iTunes, then the folks who promote podcasts would definitely take notice of it, because they keep track of that, of not only the number of reviews, but the period of time in which they come in. They say,
what does that, what does that mean? If it all happens within a week, it's good or it's bad? Or,
well, no, it's good. If, like, you know, all of a sudden a show gets 50 reviews all at once, well, somebody sits up and goes, hey, what's going on over here? So,
all right. Well, so make it your New Year's resolution to write a review. Or just star it, even.
Yeah.
Just give us the show 5 stars.
Exactly. Yeah. So any one of the podcast aggregators where podcasts are given away for free is where you can find us. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us. Our handle on Twitter is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's show on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those links to follow us and like us and subscribe to us and rate and review us, ways to contact us. Showbizsandbox.com is our website. MGMT is the group that does the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show, and they have a website. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's a little different and a little unique. Michael, what is it this week?
IStandWithPhilipPhillips.com.
Oh, I thought for sure it was going to be something about the snow, but maybe it's IStandWithPhilipPhillipsInTheSnow.com. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry there, try, the Huffington Post or MichaelGiltz.com. You can head on over to BookFilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.